This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Edwina Farley with you. Thanks for joining me and the team for a special summer series of A Big Country, where we're bringing you some of our favourite stories from regional Australia. This week, we take you back to the small community of Worrell Creek in New South Wales, where Gus Williams has turned his home into a BYO watering hole. Meet the lady who helps small hobby farmers shear their sheep. We dial up a trip down memory lane by checking out a telephone collection. It's got everything from stately old Bakelites to gaudy bright plastic ones. And we go pigeon racing in Kingaroy.
What do you like about it?
Just the joy, the excitement of seeing them coming home from a race, you know, and then going to the club and seeing that you've lost.
You'll get to meet George Simpson, also known as the Pigeon Liberator, later in the show. But let's get started with a trip to Worrell Creek and grab a beer with Gus Williams.
It's easy to miss the small rural community of Worrell Creek as you belt along the Pacific Highway on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. At first glance, there's not much to see or do here for the 250 people that call this place home. There's a primary school, a shop, and a service station. But when it comes to socialising, options are pretty limited. That is, until Gus Williams moved back to town. G'day, I'm Gabby Lyons. Gus has taken it upon himself to provide a watering hole for the whole community, turning his home into a BYO tavern.
My name's Gus. I live at Worrell Creek. If I was born and reared here, I'm only a boy yet. I'm only 72, but I've been away working at times, but mainly here, I've retired 2 years ago from trucks and earth moving gear and that sort of thing. And I'm enjoying my life now. And I have got a little tavern here, but it's not to be sold beer or anything like that. And we do have a lot of fun here at times. And I've got a band of guitars and things here. And we have a few beers. And we get a heap of people here at times. And we have the fun of our lives.
Tucked on the side of the highway, heading southbound through Worrell Creek, boxed in by the highway and the railway, stands a beautiful old homestead, lined with a green picket fence. And hanging above the garage is a sign with a Shane Warne bobblehead poised in the middle. This is the Worrell Creek Tavern. Gus has quite the setup. A handful of picnic benches with bar mats and ashtrays, all in the front yard, where inside there is a jukebox, a modest pool table, mic stands, a small wooden stage, two banjos and quite a few guitars, and a keyboard to one side. And of course, there's a beer fridge.
Tavern here, we have a lot of parties and that sort of thing, like birthday parties and that sort of thing for the family and outside people too, of course. And we play guitars and banjo, and we've got a fella who can play a banjo pretty good, and we sing. We've got karaoke, sing here, and we do have a lot of fun, a few beers, and that's probably about it sort of thing, yeah.
Have you had people ever pull up completely confused that they can't purchase beer?
We have, yeah, and a bloke pulled up here that come in and played the piano. He used to play the piano for John English. He come and he played it. Oh hell, he was good, and he lives here now. He's going to come back here. We're going to get him back here one evening. Yeah.
So how often do you have people pulling off the highway just totally intrigued by that sign?
A fair bit. Yeah. You get a lot of people come here and just turn around here and having a look, and they'll probably come in here too. And sometimes I shout them a beer or something like that. Yes. Yeah.
But why does Gus have a pop-up bar in his front yard? Other than simply having a bit of fun with the local community, he says since his wife passed away 6 months ago, the tavern has provided an opportunity for him to meet new people, start conversations, and learn more about the people who are simply passing through.
kids all come here. We had 70 or 80 come here, grandkids and all that sort of thing come here a while back. And yeah, we have those sort of shows on here. And there's always something on anyway, put it that way, yeah. Yes.
And you're a bit of a trickster, Gus. You've already shown me a couple of games, and there are some signs around us that say free beer tomorrow, full knowing that tomorrow will never come. is that a part of your character?
Yeah, that is. We like this sort of life. It's a good sign, that one, and a few other things we got here. But yeah.
I've definitely driven past on the highway once or twice where I've seen easily 80 to 100 cars parked out on the lawn here. Have you become a bit of a known personality in the Worrell Creek community?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we get some funny people out here, and it's only bring your own beer. We don't sell beer. We haven't got a license to sell it. But yeah.
So where is the closest actual tavern or pub near Worrell Creek? Where would you have to go?
How close would be? Maxville would be the closest. Yes. Yeah.
But if not, you kind of put up a location.
Yeah. Exactly. Now that's Tess.
Hi Tess, I'm Gabby. Nice to meet you.
David, this is Gabby.
Hi, I'm Gabby.
I sat with Gus and his neighbour Bluey. His daughter and her family stopped by and took a seat at the front of the tavern. And soon enough, his pal turned up with his banjo and guitar in tune. Gus assured me, this is just what happens, and people are always popping by. So if anyone happens to be driving along the old road before we have the new highway put in, a couple of kilometres, would you say, just over outside? So up until that point, if anyone happens to drive by, you ready for random guests off the highway?
I suppose so, yes. Yeah, we're always on to something, yeah.
So why do you love it? Why do you love having the tavern so-called here?
Well, I just like people. I like people hanging around and have a laugh and, tell a story and that sort of thing. We like that, yeah.
And, Gus, what's the name of your band, if anyone wanted to drop in to catch an act?
Just Worrell Creek Tavern.
So that's the band name as well?
That'll do, yes. Worrell Creek Tavern Band, yeah.
Beautiful. So if anyone pops by, just ask for Gus?
Yes, I'd say so, yeah. Yeah, I think so, yes.
Vivian, nice to see you again. Thanks very much for coming up to visit us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, George. Let's go and make a start on them and get them naked.
For hobby farmer George Wakeland, Vivian White's arrival is something to celebrate. His 15 overly shaggy sheep are in dire need of a haircut, and Vivian's the one to do it. Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols. Vivian's something of a rarity in shearing circles. For one thing, she's a woman. There's less than 100 registered female shearers in Australia. The other is, she's prepared to travel long distances to shear just a handful of sheep. And that's good news for George and other small block farmers like him around Gympie in southeast Queensland.
After a struggle to try and find shearers after the guy we've been using for years was institutionalised, really, really old, so then we struggled to find anyone under $35 per sheep, so we've gone way, way, way and found Viv. Been absolutely delightful, so we're keeping her. She's lovely.
Vivian originally hails from New Zealand and lives on a small property several hours west of here at Mergen. She travels the countryside with an animal farm show and fits in the shearing around her busy schedule.
I've been doing it for a while now, 20-something years in Australia. When I first came here, RSPCA actually found out I could shear sheep and asked me to do a couple, and it's just growing from there. One of the beauties of this job is having this machine. It's got a long electric cord so we can go further than being stuck on a stand. There are a shearers round, but they just seem to be hard to find. A lot of people just track me down and we do them. I could do more if I could just get to the places to do them.
So what does your job involve?
Well, I don't say I'm just a shearer. I offer a health service. Apart from shearing the sheep, we'll do their tails and castrate them if they need them. We'll dip them for lice, treat them for their internal worms, trim their teeth, and just generally help the people get the best out of what they've got. Now, these lovely guys are going to catch these sheep for me because I don't run around pens like a mad person. This sheep's got it's a part Dorper, and it's got about 9-10 months worth of wool on it. Nice and clean around the belly, which is its tummy, and around its bottom. And the wool is got to be classed as S wool, which means it's got shedding hair in it. Also, apart from shearing sheep, I have a company called Viv's Farm Animals, which has a very large collection of hand-raised animals, which I've raised myself on my property out west. And we love to go and do education, teach people about animals, do shows like that, and also an interactive farmyard where they can sit and hold them and cuddle them and feed them food and just get to know animals in general, sheep, goats, ducks, guinea pigs, chickens, alpacas, pigs, and whatever else we have at the time, like a turkey. We travel in big buses, and normally I come and do the shearing while I'm out between shows, so the farms and the lifestyle blocks get to see all my animals in my big buses, as well as me shearing their sheep.
Vivian White, what's your sort of range that you're willing to go to shear sheep?
Well, I go to Northern Territory every July, and I always shear one goat plus other animals in Northern Territory. And the furthest south I've done shearing is in Canberra for a show quite a few years ago, but anywhere in between, wherever people want me to be and if I'm near in the area.
Goats and sheep aren't the only fleecy animals in Vivian's shearing skill set.
Alpacas and llamas. They're fun to shear, but once you get the hang of them, they are actually not that bad.
They wouldn't be very impressed with you, have been spat on?
Oh yes, even my own occasionally disgrace themselves and turn me green. But usually I'm pretty clever. I'm the one who's shearing them. It's the holders who are holding onto them who usually turn green.
What do you love about this lifestyle?
Well, you're helping the animals because they really do need to get their wool off regularly. But you're also helping the people. And a lot of the lifestyle block people really don't have a lot of knowledge. They love the sheep, but they don't realise they need caring for.
Why do you keep sheep, George Wakeland?
We keep sheep to put the odd one in the freezer, the young boys, and the rest for the grandies. The grandies that come and run amok on and ride and be silly with.
What breeds have you got here?
Dunno. White and meat. I don't know my sheep. Ask me young fellas. Don't know, don't care. Meat sheep, dwarfers, and white sheep for wool.
I'm doing this. He's a ram. He's very strong. So it's easier to do him lying like this than fighting with him, trying to do it traditionally, in my opinion. So all you're doing is making an angrier ram.
So Vivian White, we're in an old dairy at the moment where you're shearing. Where else have you shorn?
Well, quite often in cattle yards, sheep pens, garages, carports, verandas. I've even done a few in people's kitchens because we've done them at night. Unfortunately, it's nice to shear on a flat surface. Nearly everyone has a slight slope, like the dairy here has got a slight slope. You name it, we've done it. On stages, in buildings, everywhere. You start on the belly of the sheep normally if it's got wool on it. You work it your way around its bottom, up one side and down the other side. And you have a naked sheep.
Vivian White, the lady shearer helping small hobby farmers maintain their flocks, Jennifer Nichols caught up with her on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. Still to come in this special summer edition of A Big Country, you'll meet George the Pigeon Liberator, and we dial up a trip down memory lane.
So it's basic telephone. You'd lift the handset, you'd hear if it listened for dial tone, and it's going to dial a couple of numbers.
There it is, that sound just... Would that still work, one of these phones?
Right now, the answer is yes.
Does that sound bring back memories for you? It does for me. It's an old-fashioned rotary dialing telephone, just like the one we had at home when I was a kid. G'day, I'm Anthony Pansier, and this telephone belongs to collector John Paskulich. It's one of several hundred he has in his home at Gooseberry Hill, a hillside suburb just outside of Perth.
My original reason for starting the collection was just to have a small representative sample of telephones from, you know, across the history, so I could demonstrate the historical connection. So I thought I'd have a few from the late 19th century, a few from the early to mid 20th century, a few from the late 20th century, and maybe one or two from today. And that, you know, a dozen or two telephones, and I thought that'd be enough.
Isn't that how most collections start?
But unfortunately, yes. Most collections start like that, in as much that, I wanted a dozen, but end up with probably a couple of hundred. Because you can't walk past them after a while, can you? Something pops up and you go, oh, okay, it's a bit different to the other one I've got, so I'll have it.
Now, it's probably not surprising that John loves telephones. He worked in the telecommunications business from 1965 to 1993.
I believe that communications generally is an important part of human history. I've come to the conclusion that not a lot of people are preserving examples of this history, and it's a very important part of our culture and a very important part of our development as a society. The rise of telephony in the 1880s is probably comparable in some senses to the rise of the internet in the, so the late 1990s, say, and onwards.
I'm curious, the earlier models of phones you have here, what would it actually cost? Or did it cost somebody to have one in their house? Or
Absolutely. I haven't got the figures to hand, but they weren't a cheap item, and only wealthy households or business houses would actually have a telephone.
So at what point did it become something that was exclusively for the rich or well-off to something a bit more that was common?
Well, I started work in 1965 as a technician in training with the PMG's department, and I was learning about telephones, and we didn't actually have a phone in our own home. We had to walk down the end of the street and use a public telephone. So they still weren't common in Australian households in the 60s. Probably 70s, 80s, things started to lighten up a bit, and you'll find that particularly with the plastic introduction of the plastic telephones in the mid-60s onwards, probably peaking in the 70s and 80s, was when the phone became quite common in people's houses, so probably from the 60s onwards. Yeah.
The telephone has also been a style icon through the decades. From the stately black Bakelite to the bright and colourful plastics of the 60s and 70s, the telephone has always followed the latest fashions.
Well, it's actually interesting because if you look at the very early ones, they were very decorative items, actually, and they were, you know, quite stylish. That's from a better way of putting it, I suppose. And then we went to utilitarian-looking ones probably in the 30s. And then the basic black Bakelite was a common telephone right through till the 60s, probably the 70s. And then all of a sudden, with the change of mindset and the opportunities to build these things cheaply, coloured telephones became very popular, and that was a fashion item. And if you look later on, you can actually have a look at some of the colours that were available in, certainly from about 1960s, mid-60s onwards.
Certainly some of the ones we can see here, red seems to be one of the choices, and a very peculiar shade of yellow, perhaps.
It's quite amusing. They were very much 60s popular colours in the 60s. But as you'll notice, as we go through to the 80s, all of a sudden colours became much more muted. And I think this is just a social thing, you know, bright, airy things from one particular generation moving into a different decorative item in the later years. So you have a look over there, you can see a few examples. I mean, all the ones from the 60s tend to be greens and reds and mustard yellow, and there's all sorts of colours in there, the basic grey as well, which no one liked. And then, of course, later on we go to the 80s, and they're much more muted. They're sort of more creams and what colour that is, but it's a sort of a greeny, browny colour, and so on.
And I guess as someone who's collecting the history of phones, are you a mobile phone man yourself?
There is somewhere in your life you've got to stop. As you can see, my shed is just about full of telephones. So if I collected mobiles, for starters, I'd be very, very busy because they change every fortnight, from my opinion. If you look at a telephone, people are changing their phone now, their mobile phone, on a regular basis, whereas these things would have lasted for generations. In fact, you laughed at me earlier on because I have a phone in my house which is still there from when it was built. And still working fine, whereas I'm probably on my fourth or fifth mobile telephone at this stage.
My name is George Simpson, and I am the liberator for the racing pigeons, and I am the one that takes them to each race point and releases the birds to go home.
Every weekend during the racing season, you'll find George Simpson out on the road in southern Queensland. He's got a precious cargo on board.
This white one here is a grizzle. This one here is called a blue bar.
Hundreds of racing pigeons waiting patiently in cages for the gate to drop. When released, the birds will race against the clock back to their home base, putting their speed and remarkable sense of direction to the test.
Try and look for a checker for you. The one in there is a blue checker.
Hello, I'm Jess Lodge. Today's release point is Kingaroy in the South Burnett region. 500 pigeons. How did you become responsible for 500 pigeons?
Oh, I guess they like me.
So how far are these birds going to have to travel today, and how long will it take?
It's roughly about 100 kilometres today. 100 miles, yeah. And it'll take them 9, 10, 11, just a little less than 2 hours, hopefully. Some it takes a little longer, but yeah, that's what it takes them, yeah.
How do you record the time that they get home?
They're done with an electronic timer. So they're released here at 9. When they get home, they've got these electronic rings on their feet, and when they land on the pad, it records the time. Yeah. And yeah, it's done by a velocity system then.
Pretty high-tech stuff.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is.
So how did you get into pigeon racing?
From my dad in around the late 1960s, and I've been in ever since, on and off, yeah.
Is it something he did his whole life, or...?
No, he started then in about the 60s, yeah.
What do you like about it?
Just the joy, the excitement of seeing them coming home from a race, you know, and then going to the club and seeing that you've lost.
It is pretty incredible. They can travel such vast distances and find their way home. How do they do it?
Who knows? It's, you know, I mean, they've done all sorts of tests, but yeah. They're just brainy, brainier than me. They put me in a box and took me out there. I wouldn't be able to find my way home.
Do they make good pets?
They do. They do. You just get a lot of enjoyment and relaxation from them. You really do.
So to be the pigeon liberator is a pretty important job. Talk me, what does it involve from collecting them to releasing them? Talk me through what your job is.
Well, I just get to the club and... they've all basket them up in these crates here, and they put them all there, and I just get in the truck and bring them to wherever the race point is.
You drove down to Kingaroy though pretty late last night.
Yeah, I got here 10:35 last night and sort of squish up in the front of the ute there, have a bit of a kip, and yeah, and wait till 9 o'clock and release them. Next week's Dalby, so, and it goes up and up from there.
And the weather conditions as well?
Is a big issue. You got to have pretty good weather. I mean, if it was pouring down a rain, I wouldn't be able to let them go. I'd have to probably hold them overnight until there's good weather.
They don't all make it home though, do they?
No, sometimes they get caught up with other pigeons and head other ways, and they end up hundreds of miles away and living somewhere else, yeah, and some of them, maybe the peregrine gets a few, I don't know, but yeah.
Is it more than a hobby?
Yeah, it is actually. It's a good hobby, but you know, you get a lot of enjoyment out of it. It's, yeah, they're like pets. They really are.
Yeah.
And when you lose one of your favourite, it's a bit sad for a few days. Just the joy of, you know, being with them, you know. Even if I'm not racing, I got pigeons at home, but I'm not racing, but I get joy of going there and watching them and having little fights. And, yeah, it's just, yeah, good to watch. It's so relaxing.
Yeah.
Just relaxes. You know, you're stressed out, you go to the birds, that's it, you're totally relaxed. It's good.
You know, is there a sense of pride when you win?
Oh, isn't there ever? Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a good feeling when you win, yeah.
Yeah.
It really is, yeah.
So I guess not all about the winning though, is it?
No, it's not all about the winning. I mean, yeah, it's just the joy, yeah. To see them come home after a really long race, like, you know, they'd race all day and some race even through the night and come back the next day. It's just the joy of seeing them. Yeah, it's really nice. Just taking all the water off, ready for a release. And then when I pull these out, all the doors will drop.
The moment's arrived. The clock is ticking down to 9 o'clock when George the Liberator needs to release the birds.
All right, ready? Let them go. They're on the way home already. Just about out of sight now. Just under 2 minutes gone. Very good. And now we just pack up and go home, and they're already there when we get there.
Yeah.
And let's hope all those pigeons made it home safe and sound. George Simpson, otherwise known as George the Liberator, speaking with Jess Lodge at Kingaroy in southeast Queensland. And that's it for another week on this special summer series of A Big Country. Join me, Edwina Farley, and the team at the same time next week when we'll bring you some more story highlights from rural and regional Australia. Until then, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.